diverse debate and discussion on this second episode of the Spectrum News Podcast. I'm Will Fox, your host. I'm joined today by Brian George, Shanna Schultz, and Joseph Fox. What does everybody think about the healthcare ruling today? We had a pretty big announcement at 9 a.m. The Supreme Court of the United States says healthcare mandate, individual mandate, is a yes, with Chief Justice John Roberts, usually a conservative justice, voicing for the majority opinion. Joe, you were there with me. What were your initial thoughts, man?
Well, initially I was really happy because it said on the news that they were overturning it. Thank you, CNN.
You're right. CNN and Fox announced the wrong thing for about 3 or 4 minutes. And then, believe it or not, of all networks, MSNBC waited and got it right. But go on, Joe, with your point.
Well, I don't think it's a good thing. I think it one of the liberal justices that actually sided with the dissenting opinion, Kennedy. I don't know. Is it fair to call him a liberal judge? FFOZ.
I think it's fair to call him a middle-of-the-road judge, but he wrote a pretty scathing dissent, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Well, he made the point that it does fundamentally alter the relationship between the individual and the federal government. The dissenting opinion criticized the majority for mixing up what you would call a penalty and a tax.
This was the main thing. I mean, we were talking about this a little bit before the show. That the tax justification, admittedly, even from my own perspective, is slightly awkward. If this had been, had the healthcare law been a little bit stronger, had this been something with a public option in it, if this had been even a single payer system, then the constitutionality wouldn't have even been a problem, right? But since this was a weakened bill, since this was something that meddled with private markets and putting people into private companies. This is a little bit weird, don't you think?
Well, personally, I am happy that it's still upheld because, you know, as it stands, as a college student, I'm still, you know, covered health insurance from my parents. So, like Shanna was saying before the show, I would have to go find health insurance elsewhere work
well,
or
that wouldn't,
whatever.
Well, that part of the legislation wasn't the one that was issued. It was in issue. It was the individual mandate.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Joseph, but just as easily the court could have overturned the entire law. And in fact, that's what the Obama administration had advocated, was if you throw out the individual mandate, throw out the whole thing because we can't pay for anything without bringing more people into the system.
Yeah, and I would concede that point right there. Yeah,
Shanna, I know you were excited this morning when the law was upheld. I know we haven't had a whole chance to dive into the whole 200-page report, but what are your first impressions?
My first impressions is that it's probably a good thing. I'm readily able to concede that it's probably not the perfect plan or anywhere close to the perfect plan. But something that I think that people don't consider is that. So from like 1949, when we had our first like bits and pieces of healthcare legislation, all the way until now, there's tons and tons of different mandates that formulate our kind of shaken and somewhat broken healthcare system. At least for the Affordable Care Act, it acts as a patch that can start to pinpoint problems in the status quo. So for people who really want to just reform the system and deny the Affordable Care Act, what they're failing to understand is that once this comprehensive 908-page piece of legislation is enacted, it'll be easier to pinpoint fallacies and problems in the status quo that are easily fixed by amendments or supplemental legislation, as opposed to before, where you have to go back to like 1969 and find some sort of legislative issue to fix. So I think there's potential benefits, legislatively speaking, as well as potential benefits to us as consumers.
Why isn't this the case with other markets with food? Why is this the case with healthcare and not food? Why don't we have the food is an essential service? Why do we need the government to intervene in one part of the private market? or 1/6 of it, and not in other parts. I mean, we depend on the market
clearly,
for all
they,
sorts
they
of.
They do.
I was gonna say,
but here's
do.
My, but Go not ahead. Just with food. I mean, with cars, with we there are so many things that everybody needs in a to get by in our own society that we don't need to rely on the government to regulate every single thing. It seems to me that the more we healthcare is an exception because the government's been. It seems like more of these problems pop up the more the government tries to tinker with the market. I guess that's my point.
Well, I think. Oh, sorry, Will. Go ahead.
Weak tinkering is really the issue, Joseph. And I know that you and I talk about this extensively all the time. But when you take the U.S. system and you compare it to other first world industrialized nations, you see. With even countries like Germany that still have private insurance companies, but just more government involvement and regulation, you see reduced cost, better benefits, you see higher life expectancies and lower infant mortality rates. Mm. Time and time again, you see government intervention working in other places, and the half-assed, pardon my language there, but the half-assed intervention on the part of the U.S. government, the timidness, because of our current political dichotomy is what I think is the problem here. And I think what I will do is give a quick explanation, see if anybody else wants to add to it as to what my perception of the bill is, and then we can jump into the rest of our show. This has been a really good discussion, mm-hmm, though. Mm-hmm. From the way that I see the Affordable Care Act in 2010, the way that it's been explained to me, the way that I've read it in several different sources is as follows. The Affordable Care Act sets up what is called a marketplace, which crosses state lines. And what this marketplace is a compilation by the federal government of different private healthcare options for citizens. What that allows you and I to do is, if we don't have health insurance, when this private marketplace is set up, we will be able to go onto a federal website and compare healthcare rates across state lines and pick the right plan for us. Now, if we can't afford our premiums from healthcare, there will be a tax credit to help us pay for our insurance. What bringing more people into the market does is that it overall brings more healthy people into a market that's flooded currently with older people. When you bring healthier people into the market, it lowers costs for everyone because they're less likely to have pre-existing conditions. They're less likely to have other health issues. To bring those young people in, you need to have some sort of what's now called the individual mandate. Now, the individual mandate is a requirement to buy health insurance or to at least use the tax subsidy to get it. If you don't get it, as we've been talking about, there's a fine or what's being called now a tax. I'd like to point out that if you don't pay the tax, there's no repercussions whatsoever. And that makes the healthcare mandate more of the individual pretty please, if you will. And so, essentially, you've got a plan that sets up a marketplace within the private market, you've got an individual mandate, and like we've been talking about before, you've got little provisions. You can't deny, no longer can insurance companies deny people with pre-existing conditions. People like us can stay onto their insurance until they're 26, so on and so forth. That's my understanding of the bill as it is right now. Definitely not a perfect bill, a weak bill in my opinion, an awkward bill as we've seen with this constitutional battle, but in my opinion, a step forward.
I agree. I think it's a step forward. That's basically my understanding of it, if not just a little bit different. I think that when like government sets up programs like this, in order for them to just functionally be successful, there has to be oversight. There has to be somebody directly accountable to it. Like, think of all the like sub-government agencies we have that when something happens, there's no one accountable. So like when someone dies in the Medicaid program, no one's ever responsible. They're like, is it the doctor? Is it the nurse? Is it the healthcare worker? Is it the insurance company? When FEMA like so epically screwed up, like sure, they charge the guy who was directly in charge of FEMA, but it goes so much farther than that. So like anytime we've had these like government programs that have no direct oversight because they're continually contracted out, there's no way to direct and guide those programs into being successful. So I think that something like what we're trying to implement could be successful as long as there's somebody leading it.
Excellent.
Go
ahead, Joseph.
How are they – okay, this is a question for Shanna. How are they providing oversight for this program, in your opinion, as opposed to all the other ones?
I'm not sure if they directly are. That was kind of my question. But it seems it seems like at this particular point that if they're collecting data information to postulate comparative prices with insurance premiums, then that at least regulates the kind of the kinds of prices that are going into the market, right? There's like some sort of perception on what's happening. So at least at the bare minimum, there's some sort of singular entity that's saying, all right, this premium is too high, this premium is too low. And not only is that just generally good, but it also collects information for more concise decision-making, legislatively speaking.
So, I was excited when I heard in 2008 that a candidate, a young Senator Barack Obama, wanted to close Guantanamo Bay. Just happened to have a lot of other policies I agreed with, but I, as many others, had found issues with the Guantanamo Bay detention facility on the southwestern portion of the island of Cuba. Am I correct in that? Or maybe it's the southeastern. Yeah, well, it's a long journey. It's only available through rowboat. Anywho, Gitmo was opened in 2002, you guys, and it was opened during the start of the Afghanistan conflict for combatants of that conflict. Over the course of the Afghanistan and Iraq War, it accumulated about 779 different individuals, detainees, and as of today in 2012, about 169 of those original detainees still stay at Guantanamo Bay. On the very first day of his administration, some of you may remember that Barack Obama signed an executive order changing Guantanamo policy and pledged to close down the facility within a year. This encountered all sorts of stonewalling and issues from Congress who bickered about who would take the detainees and where would they go and whether they would be given civilian trials, and basically, it got caught up in a cluster of bureaucracy, and many would argue that human rights were violated at Guantanamo Bay. Many would argue that there were lots of deep issues that went on there. Joseph, I wanna ask you, my friend. At this point in the game, I'm pretty angry with Barack Obama. This is a man who has a Nobel Peace Prize, and this Nobel Peace Prize laureate now is also violating Geneva Conventions by giving military tribunals to these detainees. And so what would you do with Guantanamo Bay? I'm mad as hell, but it's definitely a tough issue. Where do we go next?
Well, in the 2008 election, I actually agreed with John McCain's take on the issue that we should shut it down. Because it's not because, basically because it's such a sticking point with so many people. It makes us look bad holding people here and keeping it open. But I'm really surprised at how many people the anti-war left in the United States is completely dissolved with the election of Barack Obama. So at this point right now, I say keep it open.
What about this? John McCain wasn't just referring to the anti-war left at that point. He was referring to the world stage.
Yes.
Think about it as a golden rule of foreign policy. What we do to enemy combatants is what we can expect to be done to our citizens abroad if they're ever accused of being enemy combatants, or our soldiers if they're ever captured in an actual war. Shouldn't we be worried about that too, and then the stain that Guantanamo leaves on our legacy?
Well, most people, it seems, even on the international stage, it seems like the issue has kind of dissolved a little bit. Maybe I'm wrong on this. I haven't kept. There aren't too many people out what I know of that are demanding. There aren't too many.
I haven't been to the Middle East recently. It's been at least a eternity since I've been there. So,
But I mean, a lot of the groups we're fighting with right now do way worse things to our prisoners over there already. And granted, we want to say, yeah, and you're absolutely right. It doesn't make it right. We need to hold ourselves a higher standard. And I agree with you guys that, you know, if we're going to be holding people, then we need to be treating them humanely. But that doesn't mean that we shut down Guantanamo Bay. Where I disagree with you guys on is that you guys are trying to treat the prisoners we hold there like common criminals and not prisoners of war.
I don't share that opinion, but I'll let the rest of the group chime in before it comes back to me. I know Shanna was jumping at the bit to get in here, so go ahead, Shanna.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. One of the things that people typically forget about when we're talking about those who are specifically in Guantanamo Bay is that there's a huge gray area on whether or not they're prisoners of war. Because in 2006, they weren't considered that. And it took, I think, 3 years for the Geneva Convention to dictate what a prisoner of war looks like in the war on terror, since it's such an undefined war. But furthermore, in 2008, our Supreme Court ruled that Guantanamo captives were entitled to protection under the United States Constitution, specifically in the issues of, like, legal recourse. So, it talks about how tribunals are an inadequate substitute for habeas corpus, and that they're entitled to, like, due process and some of the other legal recourses that we have, and I think that's important to remember as we continue. I think the fact that Guantanamo Bay exists still is really terrible. I don't think there's any problem in detaining those who are definitely criminals and have committed awful, awful crimes against humanity. But I think there's a huge problem when there's tons and tons and tons of innocent people sitting there who have been acquitted of all charges but are not released. Like, for example, there's 36 people await trial on war crime charges since September 11th. So this is back for September 11th. So back in 2006, there are 46 in indefinite detention, but cannot be charged for anything because of lack of evidence. We want to release 32 people, but can't because of constitutional restrictions. And there's 57 prisoners who have been acquitted of all charges, but the government won't let them go. There's evidence that all these people have been raped, they've been subjected to electric shock, they've been subjected to lynching, and they've been found completely innocent. It violates our international standards, and it definitely hurts our international perceptions, which prohibits us from being successful in operations overseas. It prohibits us from using diplomatic resources with countries that we're currently having problems with. The fact that it still remains open and travesties still occur just continually deteriorates our ability to be successful anywhere abroad. And I think that the fact that Guantanamo Bay still exists in this particular manner is atrocious.
Brian, to Shanna's point, she's arguing that there's moral travesties going on here, and that, or at least there were in the past, and that's definitely a likely scenario. Even if it was just something as simple as waterboarding, I'd consider that to be an atrocity. But we're in a gray area because these are, as we've all kind of been hinting at here, these are enemy combatants. But the thing about an enemy combatant is that they are held for the duration of a conflict. But this is a war on terror. It's a vague general war that doesn't seem to have any closure or end at any given time. What do we do in this gray area where we have enemy combatants? So technically they don't necessarily get habeas corpus because they're enemy combatants, but there's no end to the war. So are they enemy combatants or are they not?
Well, that seems to be the million-dollar question here. Well, that's the thing. I think as long as there is a war on terror, so to speak, going on, there has to be a place like Guantanamo Bay to keep prisoners of war. The problem here is that they're being held, you know, without charge, without due process, and there needs to be a way where we can go through the people that we have, you know, see, try them, you know, in a system, you know, bring the charges at hand to them and get people out of there that don't need to be there. You know, innocent people should not be held indefinitely. And, you know, that's the real problem. But until there's another place to put the people who are, you know, very dangerous to the well-being of society, you know, it has to stay open.
I mean, we're not just talking about adults here. There were at least 8 different children, minors, from ages 11 to 17, sent to Guantanamo Bay. What do we do with them?
Are they still there?
I don't know if the children are still there, but they were, as of 2008, at least 8 of them were there at some point. That's according to an ACLU report, your favorite source.
Oh, yeah.
Is it known when the last person was, like, brought to Guantanamo? Like, are there people being shipped in on a regular basis, or?
I think the shipments in have stopped as soon as Obama took office. Go ahead, Joseph.
I'm in favor of there being a lot of limits on it. I think we should run it humanely as possible. I don't know why there were children at Guantanamo Bay or what they were involved with. But the assumption that all the adults there are, what are we basing this assumption of, that all these adults there are probably innocent?
We aren't assuming they're innocent, but we don't know. There's no way to know unless we give them some form of a trial, if you will, or however you want to put it. Joseph, I know you were more in favor of military tribunals, but whatever the form of justice is, it would be a lot easier to debate this if we could just find out who these men are and what they've been accused of.
True, but you guys are still approaching the issues like they're common criminals and not. We don't want to use the word. In a normal war between two recognized countries, soldiers, if an enemy soldier gets captured, you know, he gets thrown into a prison camp where he gets, you know, where all the rules for the Geneva Convention apply. There isn't really you don't try the enemy soldier for being an enemy soldier.
I have a few things. First of all, there are still children in Guantanamo Bay. Remember, children are defined as anyone under 18, I think, through international accords. There's still children. 14 and 15 is still a child. Like, they can't rationalize like adults can. An interesting other fact is that there's people in Guantanamo Bay that are 90 years old suffering from Alzheimer's and prostate cancer.
And getting free health care, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, side note.
You and Michael Moore.
But something else that's also important to note is that I think the question was raised, well, do people still come into Guantanamo Bay? And I believe they do, because one of the biggest things that irritated me about President Obama's decision is that he signed the National Defense Act, which provides indefinite detention without trial, basically undermining Supreme Court precedents that people have a right to due process who are detainees, because if they're sitting in the international gray waters of law, then the captives get to make at least some sort of jurisdictional measures over them. So what happens is you have these people who are just sitting there, and as I think I mentioned it earlier, tons of them have already been ready for release. They've been acquitted of all charges, but they can't go. They're not letting them go. And aside from like human rights violations, which I agree with whoever said it, they've probably gone down a lot since there was huge coverage over it. The fact is it's still like an awful, awful hit to our international relations. Like almost all of our European allies perceive it as another Abu Ghraib. And in fact, I think the United States is the only country that still gives life sentences to people who are under 18. And when you have children who are detained indefinitely, it's virtually the same thing. So it really hurts like our moral diplomacy across all of our operations in the Middle East. And it also hurts our ability to just functionally be successful when dealing with places like China. Like Secretary of State Hillary Clinton constantly works in China to help improve their human rights conditions. But the response is like, well, you do so great with human rights. Like, look at how you treat people. And it hurts our missions other places. So
I agree with you that could we run the prison more humanely? Yes, I do. I would agree with you on that. But should we close down the prison and what would your alternative be? The ones we know definitely are guilty. What do we do with those?
If I could butt in for a second here.
Yeah, Brian.
I think the prison at this point is being ran pretty dang humanely at this point, at least for cooperative, you know, prisoners. They spend $4 million a year feeding these people. You know, they feed them so well that obesity is a problem in the premises, you know? And so, you know, the cooperative prisoners have, you know, up to 20 hours a day of recreation time. You know, they have access to 15,000 books. You know, they have all this stuff in their hands. So I think the, you know, argument of inhumane treatment at this point is almost irrelevant.
Well, one, and another point that's brought up with the waterboarding wasn't done to every single, whether or not you think waterboarding was torture, it wasn't done to every single prisoner over there. It was done to a few prisoners a lot, which I'm not saying, I'm not saying that makes it right, but I guess what I'm trying to point out is not every single prisoner was treated, you know, was tortured 24/7.
Well, I think with what Brian said, though, I think he's totally right. Ever since, like, Human Rights Watch uncovered everything that was going there, rights conditions improved tremendously. But I think what Will and I are saying is that it's still a violation to be detained with no cause, no evidence, and not released, right? So, like, even if you're living a pseudo lap of luxury, I don't think it's right to keep people from living their lives and being with their family. So I think now it's kind of turned into, like, can people have access to legal recourse, including the bad guys, right? Those are the ones we care about the most. We want them to go to trial. We want them to be accountable for their actions. And we want them to be, you know, put on the pedestal in the international community of being like, hey, you're the worst person in the world. You should never set foot in daylight again.
Okay.
And Brian, think about it this way. You do a remodeling of Auschwitz. And you clear, it's still Auschwitz. Like, you can put a tennis court there, but there were still people who died there. That's I'm not trying to compare Guantanamo to
Godwin's Law strikes again.
It's just for making my point. Just a rhetorical device there. But the idea that the legacy of Guantanamo is what overshadows no matter what else goes on, whether or not the detainees are able to read the Quran and play soccer simultaneously is irrelevant.
About 500 BC and the streets of Athens. Students and philosophers considered, argued, and resolved issues of state as well as politics of the time. In 17th century Europe, coffee houses were introduced as the hub for political discourse. In fact, the discourse was so effective that Charles II tried to ban them because he considered them a threat to his kingdom. In 2010, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, Bahrain, Jordan, and many other countries participated in multiple protests and demonstrations against the status quo, which has since been labeled the Arab Spring. The successful mobilization of thousands of different people rallying under one idea and in one place was attributed to the use of social media outlets. These outlets exchanged information, ideas, and successfully showed the history of Arab nations unfolding before our eyes. Here in the United States, internet users spend the majority, 42% to be exact, of their time looking at content such as news, information, blogs, and other data. This statistic does not include social media like Facebook or YouTube. I know, I was genuinely surprised at this as well. This leads us to the question of the relationship between internet usage, the ability to access information, and how that relates to social mobility. For those who may not be familiar, social mobility in this context refers to the ability for certain socioeconomic classes to have vertical movement in society. There is different and complex forms of capital that lead to mobility. We will be focusing on social capital, which deals with the range of social networks that protect against downward mobility, cultural capital, which can help middle-class families confer social advantages to their children, increase their future mobility, and last, and probably most important to this discussion, will be educational capital, which according to most research is the most important factor influencing social mobility. Now, how does this relate to the internet? The internet provides three advantages, generally speaking, of course. The first one is access to wide, diverse information on multiple topics. The second is that it's cheaper than the alternative access of information, such as higher education or specialized technical information. And the third is that it's easily sorted. Most information can be stacked, searched, and correlated for easy use. I'm sure that each member of this panel has utilized all three of these advantages sometime this week. So first, let me ask Joe, as an educator, what do you think the correlation between access to the internet and ability to utilize information? Does one even exist?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've been in the school districts. We've been trying to find all sorts of different ways to add in, you know, computers or laptops. In San Marcos, at San Marcos High School, they actually use iPads, which is really cool. Yeah, it is a really great resource, and most kids that we have in the classroom are already very, very familiar with how to use a computer. So it's almost, whenever you're trying to explain to somebody, you always want to use whenever you're trying to explain something to somebody, you always want to use a medium that they can understand. And educators have been using internet more and more just because so many kids get on it.
Do you think that if the internet didn't exist, our 2012 students could be as successful in school as they are now?
That's a difficult question. People were very successful even before the internet, even before we have mass internet. It's such a radical concept. keep in mind that the internet, it's a new tool that it makes it easier to look up stuff. But on a college campus, people would go to the library and look up the. They would look up their book. They would look it up in like a book or whatever. So I guess to answer your question, people can be successful without internet, but internet makes being successful easier. Does that make any sense?
Let me ask you one more question as an educator. If there was a student that you had, that didn't have access to the internet, like they couldn't go to the library and the school you worked at didn't have any, would that student perform as well as his peers?
I would say yes. A lot of the stuff we do, we try to incorporate internet. But a lot of stuff we do is, we try to make it accessible to anything. You don't need the internet to take notes or do any of the assignments or to study your notes or anything like that. but it does help.
Yeah, okay.
It does. It certainly does help.
If Joe is their teacher, they'll do great no matter what.
Thank you.
That was nice. But I think it seems like there's a lot to be said about the necessity of the internet and to education, which, as we've seen, is key to social mobility. So currently, in the United States, almost 69 million people do not have access to the internet. Now, granted, there is a portion of that population that just flat out aren't interested in the internet. Maybe they're part of AARP. I don't know. But according to a Pew Research study in 2010, 15 million of those people flat out can't afford it and can't have access to it. So, considering these factors, Brian, as well as the latest census figures that say that 1 in 2 people are considered low income, should there be some kind of city, state, or national incentive that allows public access to the internet?
Well, what exactly is considered low income by census standards?
I think the census standard is a family of four under $38,000 a year.
Okay. Well, the reason I was asking, because there's an interesting report by the Washington Examiner that reported that 63% of people below the poverty line in this country are paying for cable or satellite TV. So, I mean, these people below the poverty line have some sort of disposable income that they're choosing to buy cable TV with, you know, that's affordable enough to where they can afford it below the poverty line. So, you know, who's not to say, you know, a few years down the road, internet would be affordable enough for people below the poverty line to afford. And just kind of also going on what Joe said, you know, by the time I was in sixth grade, I was on a computer, you know, two or three times a week in public schools. So I think the government right now is doing, you know, just fine getting people exposed to the internet. You know, I don't think there's anything more they need to do at this point.
Let me pose a question for you. If your argument about the private sector will continually lower their rates for internet service as the demand gets higher, if that were true, then wouldn't we see like market prices decreasing as we speak. So for example, my family has always had internet since it began because my mother worked for the Houston Chronicle. So they provided it for us. Right. And it was the same price really for everybody. This was back in like, dial up days, like, yeah.
Skrillex.
But as more options became available, like there's cable, there's satellite, and there's DSL, the prices began to fluctuate. So now the average person pays over $80 a month, which comes out to some number times 12 a year that I can't do in my head at this moment, as part of their income for internet. So doesn't it seem like the private market is making internet more expensive rather than lessening the cost?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's going to be competition, as always, with the internet. You know, me as a college student working a part-time job, I'm able to support myself fully and completely and can also afford internet. And, you know, I'm not making any sort of money right now. You know, I'm working part-time in a grocery store, and I myself can't afford internet, you know, squeeze it into the budget. You know, there's always, with the private sector, there's competition that drives prices. And regardless of the private sector, the government right now at this point is providing internet access to just about anyone in this country who is willing enough to go out and find it.
Get it for Shanna, free. What? I'm sorry. Right, random question. What was the percentage you said for people who can't afford or who don't have internet in the United States?
It's
22%.
It's 15 million people, which roughly comes out to 22%. Right. So let me ask Will. Do you think the private market will drive prices to the bottom, or it'll become a race to the top for the best technology?
I don't think they have to drive prices to the bottom necessarily. To Brian's point earlier, he was simply saying that for these low-income families, if they're able to afford cable, if they're able to afford satellite TV, which we all know is definitely just a disposable extra, then internet should be an option. And there's definitely affordable internet options out there. Not everybody can afford the high-end stuff that we're talking about. For example, I'm well aware of just normal DSL being somewhere in the realm of $20 a month, maybe a little bit more, maybe slightly less depending on where you are geographically. So it is important for people to have access to the internet, and the idea that the internet should be widely available for people, I definitely agree with that sentiment. However, the idea that the internet is not already available to the point of Joseph earlier, I think is slightly fallacious. I think if we consider internet a human right, which I think that it is important that everyone have access to the internet, then I think that we're actually already meeting that standard by providing it in certain public areas. And there's also evidence to say that when government tries to bring themselves into the internet and provide it universally, if you will, that there are certain hiccups to that. For example, I was just looking into Seattle's program, because Seattle's the poster child for universal internet, so to speak. And just a couple months ago, back in March, they had to shut down their citywide Wi-Fi program because it was just too expensive to upkeep. And one of the reasons they mentioned is that most people have access to the internet anyway, whether it be on their smartphone or for people who can't afford it at the public library. So to answer your question, the private market will inevitably provide options for people who are lower income. They do it, for example, with cable, like Brian was saying, and they'll do it again and are doing it with internet.
What's your argument for internet increasing social mobility? Because, you know, the internet was, you know, kind of the advent of the internet was in the 90s with the dot-com bubble. But couldn't you also make the argument that since then, income inequality has actually increased?
Absolutely not. Like, if anything that we've seen in the past 4 years is that the income gap has increased exponentially between the three social economic classes. The argument for social mobility being linked to the internet is that internet is key to education. So as the three things I mentioned earlier, is that people can do recreational education through the internet. They're exposed to a wide range of ideas, right? If you look to the example of the Arab Spring, the reason why there was so much successful mobilization is because the ideas spread much faster, much quicker, and to a much larger group of people. Now, the thing that's potentially dangerous is if you have the poorest people in your country not exposed to new ideas, not exposed to progressive policies, not exposed to basic elements of education as far as like our social standards goes, then they're always going to be downwardly mobile because they're not going to be able to interact with those higher classes. It's called technological gaps.
I think. Go ahead. Finish your point.
Oh, so the question is people without internet because they can't afford it, are they being disenfranchised from this mobility process?
I think Shannon and I would just set the bar in different places because I agree with you, Shannon. I think the internet's incredibly important. But I would set the bar a little bit lower. Not that everyone should have instant or readily access to the internet. Not that they should have it available while they're, you know, sitting and watching the Jersey Shore. Not when they're simply walking down the street. But maybe 3 or 4 times a week that it's something they could go to when they need it, when they're applying for a job or doing research on something or getting that educational opportunity you were speaking of. That they have access to it then, but not access to it all the time.
I think internet reduces social mobility because once people find World of Warcraft, they become neither social nor mobile. Because they don't do much moving from their computer to their fridge. That's about it.
How long have you been buffering that joke?
Here's my take. I think as far as internet being all right, I just don't see the need for the government getting involved in the process. Why do we need the government getting involved when already the United States has, according to most estimates, we have 79% of the population using internet. It's right up there. It's with all other modern countries, and it's readily available, affordable for most people to get it on their own. Why do we need the government involved in the process?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Interesting.
I mean, they are involved some way right now. I just think that what they're doing right now is, I don't think they need to do any more. I think what they're doing now is, you know, capable enough of giving anyone access who wants it.
All right, guys, we're going to try something new this week called Yay or Nay. In Yay or Nay, we're going to give quick answers and quick responses. Also acceptable, besides yay and nay, you could say indubitably or preposterous, or you could say happy dance or sad panda, or my personal favorite is carpe diem or hell no YOLO. So let's move on to our first quick yay or nay topic, cell phones in school. I'm going to go around the circle. Cell phones in school. Joseph, you're a teacher. It drives you absolutely crazy when students are using their cell phones. Should they be allowed to have them?
You read my mind. Nay. I'm giving 2 thumbs down right now. Nay. It's just...
Shanna, should students be allowed to have cell phones in school?
Preposterous.
Then why?
They're a major distraction, a source for theft and bullying, as well as unnecessary. Lining up at the local payphone is the way inner-city kids really connect with their drug dealers.
Comment awesome. Of the night right there.
Racist. Damn it. That's racist.
That was excellent. No one's going to top that.
Ryan?
Brian? Should students have cell phones in school?
Yeah, give them cell phones, but then also put some shock collars on them so when they whip it out, you can just hit a button. No, I think they should have them, you know, for emergency purposes and whatnot. And I think...
Yay. I'm saying yes as well for the emergency reason, but also because, I mean... I remember when I was in college or when I was in high school, like everyone had a Razor phone and I didn't have a Razor phone and I just wanted to be cool too. I didn't have anybody to text. I just wanted to have the phone. It was
you
shiny.
Can have a Razor phone now.
Got my Nokia sidekick.
Well, it's cool now. If we don't allow cell phones in school, then the trendy thing would be not to have a cell phone because that's what everybody else is doing.
Nah, the trendy thing would to be, hide it and be a martyr.
The real goal is to eliminate cell phones so Gigapets can come back.
Tamagotchi.
Yeah, Cameron knows. He has all the different collectible Gigapets in his closet. He's so disappointed when he said they died. Did you hear that? I had no one else to breed with. Oh, I was so disappointed.
speaking of which, let's go on to Title IX. Title IX is a federal provision that doesn't allow employers or colleges or other organizations to discriminate based on gender. It's just recently been renewed, if I'm not mistaken. Isn't that correct, Shanna?
Brian, tell me about Title IX.
I think proportionality is...
yay or nay?
Nay. I think proportionality is bullcrap and has no room in society.
Shanna?
Yay. Totally yay. Obviously, no one should be denied the ability to play a sport based on their sex. Besides, allowing girls to play sports is what drives beer, Gatorade, and women fitness magazines markets. And we're better at tennis and race car driving.
It's also brought us the WNBA, though.
Yeah, we're... Dude, I don't even want to get on this topic.
Technically, Title IX only applies to college division.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Joseph.
I would have to say yay, but I wonder if there... Is there a addition to the new one that disallows colleges to discriminate in the name of diversity?
No.
No.
Yeah.
Hey, how many...
No, because Title IX acts the way it does right now. Like, female sports are female sports and male sports are male sports.
Yeah, and thousands of men's sports programs have gotten cut because they weren't proportionate, just because so they would their universities wouldn't get sued by
lawyers. I think I just completely misunderstood what we were talking about. Okay, yay. Forget what I said. I'm on my third beer.
All right, well, I'm going to go with indubitably, not only because it's common sense, but Shannon's here, and I just want to stay on your good side. Okay, let's talk about a Houston tax recently passed that puts a $5 tax on strip clubs' entry in order to fund undetected rape or untested rape kits to finish lab work for incomplete sex crime investigations. So basically, the money from the tax goes to helping victims of sexual assault. Brian, yay or nay?
I say absolutely yay, and the tax should be variable based on the stripper's cup size.
Shanna?
Absolutely, it's a yay. The connection doesn't matter. It's still a revenue source. I think that if stripping empowers women, then paying a fee that helps other women and victims feel empowered through legal recourse is karmic synergy and good for our legal system.
I'm going to have to go with carpe diem, strippers. I love it, not just because it's been coined the poll tax, but because in doing so, you nonetheless link strip clubs and Jim Crow laws. Yeah, it was a little ancient there. My references are a little out of date. Let's talk about the healthcare reform law. I want everyone to go around and give a one-word description that defines their impressions of the healthcare law. And this isn't yay or nay. This is just a one-word description. Mine is Roberts? Joseph?
I was going to say crap, but I liked yours.
Brian?
Okay. Eh.
Shanna?
I actually depicted the healthcare ruling today in Roger and Ebert form, if anyone wants to know.
Oh.
I'll read it to you like this. The Supreme Court ruling was like a well-thought-out suspense film. They kept us on edge for months with monotonous storylines called closing statements. Then they leaked information this morning that commentators reported as the individual mandate being repealed. And in a thrilling plot twist, it was in fact not. And most unlikely of heroes delivered the message. It was Justice Roberts with the gavel in the entryway. Overall, I give it a thumbs up.
Wait, who's...
Damn, Wadsworth.
Who's on first?
That was awesome.
Very clever.
I love it. Guys, let's talk about everyone's favorite subject, roads. So
Subways.
We all know that we're kind of within a recession, within a depression, if you will. We're kind of experiencing an economic slowdown amidst a timid recovery. And so everyone's wondering, what are we going to do to stimulate the economy? At the same time, a 2010 study finds the U.S. 23rd, just above the South American nation of Chile, in infrastructure quality. And I think that the Minneapolis I-35 bridge collapsed in 2007, is just a ridiculous example of how roads and bridges across the nation need repair. Now, I'm pretty sure that everybody here, in some capacity, thinks that we should be taking care of our infrastructure. But where I think we might disagree is whether or not infrastructure improvements bring economic stimulus, whether they bring benefits to the economy both short and long term. Brian, I know you feel relatively strongly on this. Does infrastructure, does spending on roads and bridges, putting people to work to do those sorts of projects, does that stimulate the economy in any beneficial way?
Absolutely. Especially in the long term, you know, the short term, I'm not, you know, so confident on, but especially in the long term, you know, these roads and these bridges are things that need, you know, to be maintained. You know, as we've seen these things fail, like the recent bridge collapse, and you know how many potholes you go through on your way to, you know, work or class every day. So these are things that need to be done, and creating these jobs not only, you know, will give people who are unemployed a chance for work, but it also gives people who are untrained a way to become trained labor and become a skilled worker and more suitably contribute to the workforce.
It does provide a lot of economic it does provide a lot of economic benefits. That's what I meant to say. You know, to have these roads, but isn't an economic stimulus. You guys got to keep in mind that the government doesn't magically create money out of nowhere. It takes it from the private sector and puts it in other places. Historically, if you boom periods that we've had, period of sustained economic growth, like the 50s or the 90s, or the 80s, happened when we actually cut government spending, because that frees up capital in the private sector better.
You don't think that the spending, because there was, sure, there were defense cuts in the 50s, but there was also economic prosperity for many different reasons, one of which being a giant stimulus package, if you will, that was World War II, in employing all sorts of men and women to do all sorts of jobs that centered around the war.
But even that stimulus that you're talking about right there, it's a drastic drawdown from the amount of spending we had during World War II. That's something that you can't overlook.
And what about the big recession in 56, 57, just at the start of Eisenhower's second term? I mean, that could be accredited at least partially to natural things in the economy, but I mean, based on your argument, that could be also directly accredited to the decrease in spending.
Somebody did their homework.
I try.
You try.
You use that statement a lot as a teacher, don't you, Jim?
No, he doesn't, actually.
No one does their homework.
Nobody does their homework.
Because they're on their phones.
Well, let's bring it back. Let's bring it back to infrastructure here.
Yeah, hold on. Okay. I will say this. Whenever you cut the spigot, there, if your economic growth is dependent on nothing but how much money the government spends in the economy, then when you cut that spigot, then you will see a little bit of a decrease in economic growth. It takes a little bit of time.
Sure.
That would be my one.
Okay. Shannon, do you think that this would, I mean, Brian, Cameron are saying that this is a needed reform, needed spending anyway, and just by chance also stimulates the economy. Joseph says, not so much. We're going to have to improve our infrastructure at some point, but it's not going to get the sort of benefits that we're talking about. We're living in a fantasy land. Not to mischaracterize Joseph's words there, but Shanna, what's your take on the topic?
I believe that at first glance, the idea of like $260 billion over 5 years or whatever outrageous numbers people throw at us all the time is indeed intimidating, that it looks like it's like a regulatory overreach and some sort of like redundancy. However, I do believe that as our population increases, as our energy policies change, that having stable infrastructure is critical to mobility for commuting to work, commuting to your educational institution for basic necessity of life. At this particular point in our nation's standing, there is no good system of public transportation in most large metropolitan cities. Sure, there's lots of exceptions, but overall, it's expensive to travel cross-country, and it's expensive to travel across certain states, especially big ones like Texas. So I think that until we can get to a point where there's probably like some sort of fantastic railway system, whether that comes from the private market or it comes from a government project, the in-between time needs to be spent on repairing our infrastructure. Now, what does this do for jobs, right? Like, what does this give back to the economy when it takes so much? Well, it gives two things. Even if you concede that there is a small fiscal bump in our economy through these, I guess, what we would think of as short-term jobs, I think it goes a lot further than that. Because what happens is with this proposal, more money is distributed and flexible for construction companies, which in February lost 17% of their workforce for like lack of funding, or lack of money rather, not funding, that's not the right word. And so I think that when we do these types of infrastructures build, not only can you employ people for the short term, there's more lucrative money in each of these companies to hire permanent workers. And if you happen to be that short term person that only gets the 2-year contract, you have a valuable skill on your resume that makes you more marketable to future employers as the economy begins to recover. Specifically, for the Energy and Infrastructure Jobs Act, the one that we were talking about, I've actually really enjoyed watching the way it develops, because not only does it deal with the way that we do infrastructure and creating temporary and long-term solutions for our workforce, it also incentivizes low-cost and clean energy, as well as rejected the inclusion of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which I particularly care about. So if it can be successful, and this proposal does lend towards research and development of more low-cost energy, then that gives you more jobs in the green sector. Even if you don't care about energy efficiency or whatever, there's still an industry out there looking for more people to be employed in it. So even if they're temporary, there's still more skills that go into a whole new industry, such as the green jobs. I'm not seeing too many pitfalls in this particular program.
Think about it this way. To add to your point, Shanna, if we're talking about a main criticism of this would be that the short-term spending, these short-term jobs, don't turn around and necessarily become long-term jobs. Now, you're saying that this is skill sets that one can take into the private sector, that these are leadership skills or work-related labor skills that are necessary for finding other jobs. I would add another subtlety to that, another element, and that is, right now, a big problem among the unemployed is that when they go to find jobs, they're discriminated against based on the fact that they're unemployed. Employers, for whatever reason, want to find people who are currently working to take the open positions they have. And so think about it this way. You're hired short term. You can look for a long term job and not have to worry about that discrimination because you've got this short term job working on infrastructure.
But you're making the assumption that this stimulus is immediate. As we saw with the last stimulus, it wasn't dealt that immediate. If it was, that's how stimulus works to its best. But even then, our regulatory structure is built in such a way that it takes a long time for a lot of this cash to make its way into the economy. And then on top of that, you're also we're piling up on our own debt. I think that's the biggest thing that a lot of people are nervous about right now in our economy. It's the fact that we have our debt is almost like 100% of our GDP right now, over 100%. I think if we could before we start, you know, trying to build before we start creating these infrastructure projects, if we could first find a way to get our house in order, put a solid plan to get us on track debt-wise, I think that would give us a huge, the private sector, a huge boost in confidence that we sorely need right now.
I hate to be too much of a partisan, but instead of building roads in Afghanistan, let's build some roads here. Brian, you...
Yes, and I would be willing to concede that right there. We do spend too much on foreign policy. But still, the... even when you take into foreign policy, the biggest drivers of our debt right now are domestic.
There's also, it doesn't help that there's no growth and there's no, and no one wants to spend money whatsoever. You know, overall, the debt held by Americans is probably more of a strain on the economy than the debt held by the government. Go ahead, Shanna.
Well, and I also think that when Joe was talking specifically about, like, getting our house in order, I think something that's important to note is that while legislators can sit in their comfortable offices picking apart different pieces of legislation, seeing where they can cut out from, people are still unemployed. At least with this piece of legislation, you have employment at least for 3 years. So when we talk about immediate benefits, I'm not talking about the day that it's signed into, you know, legislation that we see results the next day. I'm talking about 5 years. That would be immediate to me. What happens is once that occurs and this small amount of employment of like 3 years or so, that's more revenue that people have to spend. The difference between an economic stimulus package like what was passed in the Bush and Obama administration is that when people received that money, they perceived it as a one-time benefit. So they saved it instead of using it as capital in the industry. The difference with a continual paycheck and continual income over the next 3 years is that's more tax refunds for them to spend on luxury items. It's more income in their pocket to spend on day-to-day items. So in order for our house to get in order, it requires for the economy to get jump-started in another way, especially with what Will said about having more growth. If more jobs can be diverted into green industry, which is a new industry and can be traded internationally, which is a market that is untapped, then you'll see huge amounts of growth in our GDP that can lend to helping the debt problem.
Well, the last 4 years should be ample demonstration that of why stimulus spending doesn't work. All the estimates of how we were told when we initially passed the stimulus package that it was going to, they called it the summer was going to be the summer of recovery. I can't remember Barack Obama's specific promise, but all the estimates for how much it would lower the unemployment rate.
It would keep it below 8% or 9%, I think he said.
And all those were wildly overblown, as Obama himself said, and I know this is such a Republican talking point, shovel-ready wasn't as shovel-ready as we thought. And a lot of these green jobs you're mentioning, a lot of them owe their very existence. They're not competing on their own in the marketplace. They're being propped. They wouldn't be there without the government. They're being propped up. That type of growth is not sustainable in the long run.
Because there's nobody trained to work in that industry yet. So that's the benefit of a plan like this, is because it gets people trained in that industry so it can become a private sector type of industry. But furthermore, I think I would dispute with what you said. Over the past 4 years, there's been a decrease in unemployment. I think that's a benefit, right? Like...
But is that? But it's almost like the witch doctor that does a rain dance and it starts raining a little bit and he says, "Oh, what I was doing was working."
No, I think this is a direct result of progress.
Is this a direct result of all the stimulus spending?
It'll be impossible in a complex.
It seems to me we're just shifting around resources to less productive areas in the private sector.
Well, in a complex economic system like what the United States has, it's impossible to pinpoint one area that either helps or hinders the economy. Like, it's a little fallacious to say, oh, it was the housing market that just crippled our economy, because there's too many actors that work in the economy that we have. But I think it's safe to say that a very good correlation would be the kind of spending and job creation that came from the federal level. I don't think it's wrong to assume that that helped decrease the unemployment from 10% to 8%.
I think going off of what you're saying, Shanna, housing properties and the housing market, these things are all intertwined. For example, there's a strong correlation between a powerful and vibrant infrastructure that works well and increased property values. There's primary and secondary roads that work better, that go to different places, relieve traffic, and even small things like that can make your home more valuable. So there's little relationships in the economy that infrastructure spending would help with. And again, like to come full circle here, this is spending that needs to be done anyway. So we can talk about how we're going to find the money. We're going to talk about what we're going to cut from to get the money. But I don't think anyone would disagree that at some level it has to be done. And so it's been a good debate talking about whether or not this would promote the kind of growth that we're searching for. It's now time for Asshole of the Week, a weekly riveting of people who make our lives worse. Who would like to go first?
I'll go first.
Brian.
Mine's, I don't know. I'll throw mine out there. My nominees for Asshole of the Week are the armchair activists, mostly seen on social media sites. You know, I was looking today, browsing the Facebooks, when I came across, you know, the meme that said, "Brace yourself, everyone on Facebook is about to become a constitutional scholar." And I just like to throw, you know, those people who butt in and, you know, just try to flex their, you know, philosophical superiority, you know, just regurgitating this info they hear on TV or from their parents or wherever, you know, just every once in a while to, you know, kind of put their chin up and feel better about other people. You know, this was widely seen with the Coney 2012 thing a few months ago, which we all know how that turned out. So those are my nominees for Assholes of the Week, the armchair activists.
Oh, those armchair activists. How bored they got whenever the Coney 2012 guy was caught naked performing acts on himself in the middle of the street in the day. Joseph, who is your nominee for the week besides Brian?
Okay, my nominee of the week, and I'm completely pulling this out of my ass, but it's you, Will. You introduced me to the website Creepypasta, which is this website that's devoted to, it's all this creepy, these creepy stories that people make up on the internet. And the moment I got home from San Marcos today, I spent 2 hours just looking stuff up, just because it's addictive. And but now I forgot that I live in a single bedroom apartment, so now I'm probably not going to get any sleep at all tonight, all because I looked up all that creepy stuff on the internet. So thank you, Will. You're my asshole of the week.
Oh, you're very. Yeah, I'm glad to be a nominee for asshole of the week. Shannon.
Okay. My nominee is Ben Shapiro.
That asshole. No, wait, who's that?
He's an American conservative political commentator, radio talk show
host. Oh, that's enough right there. And, that's enough.
And media consultant. He tweeted today that this, meaning the SCOTUS decision, is the greatest destruction of individual liberty since Dred Scott. Yes, because paving way for people to get medical aid is the same as denying them life because of their skin color. Comments like this deteriorate the seriousness of our past history and undermine the respect of the progress of civil liberties in the U.S., and it's overall idiotic.
Wow.
Total jerk.
These are some serious assholes of the week, you
that
guys.
Was a dreadful comment you made.
Oh, wow.
Gotta put the mustache up to laugh at that one.
Man, Brian, you really slaved away at that pun. Anyway.
Oh, God.
Dude, this can get really bad really fast, so I'm just gonna stop.
This is cut right now. Oh, God. Okay, before we offend people over state lines, that was a way more subtle Dred Scott reference. Okay, so my asshole of the week is who I'm going to refer to as random TSA agent, or TS asshole, if you will. A gentleman, this is not the same guy, a gentleman by the name of John Gross of Indianapolis was traveling back to Indianapolis, his home, from Florida. And what he brought with him was the ashes of his grandfather in a sealed container, clearly marked human remains. And as John Gross went through the security line, he ran across this TS asshole, who said, "What is that, sir?" and pulled the jar of human remains and Mr. Gross over to the side. Now, John Gross, being a reasonable man, said, "Hey, please, be careful, TS asshole. Please, my grandfather's remains are in that jar." To which the TS asshole replied, "I will need to open this up and look inside." He did. He broke the seal. He opened the jar of ashes and proceeded to rub his grimy finger into the ashes. That's not all. In the midst of rubbing his finger in the ashes, he spilled them on the floor. John Gross was then forced to get down on his hands and knees and attempt to try to scramble together the ashes and probably bone fragments of his dead grandfather.
Yeah.
And rather than apologize, T.S. Asshole proceeded to laugh as John Gross scraped up ashes in front of hundreds of other people at the airport. And for that reason, T.S. Asshole is my nominee for asshole.
Damn it, where do you find these stories? God damn it.
Reddit. Where else would I get these things?
I thought he was about to say, "These are the worst assholes I've ever seen." That would have been funnier.
How do we do this? Since everyone nominated, there's no one left to vote.
Well, we can just not vote for yourself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true. Okay.
Jeez.
I'll start off. Rocket I guess science. I'll vote for the... I guess I'll vote for the armchair activist. Yeah. I thought that was pretty asshole.
I don't know.
That was pretty asshole.
That was... Brian?
I'm gonna have to go with T.S. Asshole making the guy scoop up his grandpa's femur into a jar.
Whenever you said femur, I instantly thought of lemur. I don't know exactly why, but
well,
now I
his grandfather was a lemur. You ever heard of Evolution, Will?
Oh, yes, and the Kratt Brothers.
Evolution's just a theory, Brian.
Shanna, who's your asshole of the week?
First of all, Zaboomafoo was not terrible, and those brothers were very attractive.
I love the Kratt Brothers, but not Zaboomafoo.
Dude, that show was awesome.
Anyways. The armchair activists irk me, but I think they're a pivotal part of our First Amendment rights, so I have to go with TSA agent, because he is not part of our rights, and he is awful.
So.
God.
Two for two right now. Joe, you're the deciding vote.
I was vote last time. Holy crap.
You were.
All right. Well, Mr. Roberts or Kennedy.
I would like to point out that, you know, this is the perfect, you know, this really buttresses, you know, the armchair activist argument, since we are four people at our computers discussing our opinions about politics right now.
Wait.
Our five people.
Well,
true, but did you just use the verb butt?
Yes.
that hasn't been used since the Geneva Convention.
You haven't heard that.
We really buttress the detainees at Guantanamo.
Oh, they got some buttress in them, let me tell you.
Sounds like I feel like being an asshole of the week would like, we should make an alternative definition for buttress. That is just being an asshole.
Okay.
Joe, what is it?
All right, drum roll, please. Anybody else? I gotta go with the TSA agent, just because that's such a dick move. He spilled the guy's grandfather's ashes on the ground, and while he picks it up, you're laughing at him.
Hey, well, what would we all be saying if he didn't search it and then he blew up a plane with his grandfather's remain jar?
Or and laughed at the man
yeah.
if he blew up. That's
I know,
a bad
I'm just kidding. But seriously.
That's some other good ones.
Well, he should have put his grandfather's remain
I'm just
in his
trolling.
Underwear band.
And, is that what you said?
And that's our... And that's our show for the second installment of the Spectrum News Podcast. I'm Will Fox. You can send us feedback to the threesidedcoinnews@gmail.com. Also, you can follow us at Twitter at the number 3 sided coin. Thanks for listening.